Welcome back to this special Think Tank Roundtable on Quality and Value in Oncology Care. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. As an addendum to this fascinating day, I met with a key person who was scheduled to attend the Think Tank, but at the last minute was unable to attend, Dr. John Sprandio, who has a leading role in developing and implementing an important concept related to the issue of quality, the patient-centered medical home, or PCMH, which essentially is a way of organizing medical care that emphasizes coordination and communication. I asked Dr. Sprandio to summarize the frequent presentations he does to discuss the origin of the PCMH concept more than four decades ago.
It was designed initially by the pediatric folks around special needs children. It was kids who were chronically ill and were high consumers of healthcare. And it was a great concept. It was 40 years before its time. And the limitations in the application beyond specialty centers that related to pediatric cases was really data systems and the ability for providers to execute care at that level. The idea of having a personal physician coordinating comprehensive care, directing the care team, whole person orientation from the time of acute care through chronic care and end of life. You know, this is applicable to oncology. Again, these are the primary care joint principles. The importance of providing coordinated and integrated care across all aspects of the healthcare system, using information technology, focusing on quality and safety with continuous improvement of the execution of care, enhancing access for patients, and then having an appropriate payment model that would align providers to redesign their care. Those are the joint principles in primary care, but they're applicable to, as I said, anything that's remotely resembling healthcare delivery. One of the other things, Neil, that I like to mention is the standards, the six standards that the NCQA puts forth, again, in primary care, which is really about enhancing access, identifying and managing patient populations, planning and managing care, providing community support, tracking and coordinating care, and measuring and improving performance. And these are the standards that are validated and have tested elements and features under each standard. And a lot of them are widely applicable to any chronic care model with modifications. At the same time, you know, the American College of Physicians in 2010 came out with the concept of, it was the specialty society's arm of the American College of Physicians, got together over a two-year period and thought, gee, you know, primary care has a PCMH model. You know, where do the specialists fit in? And they established a definition for patient-centered medical home neighbor, meaning the specialists were the neighbors. They approved a framework to categorize interactions between primary and specialist, and they approved guiding principles for the development of care coordination. They call them agreements, we call them arrangements, between primary care PCMH practices and specialty care practices that, again, embrace this model of chronic care delivery model. So that was happening in the background through 2010. And also happening, you know, in concert with that is the era of healthcare reform, which is really about value and defining value as a provider and demonstrating results. And, you know, value, I like to remind folks during these presentations about what quality really is, and I'll get to that in a second, but the concept of driving quality or the need to provide a standardization of process that drives consistency of execution is critical to improving the quality of care that we are delivering as practitioners. So it's really about a focus on execution and incorporating some, you know, very common, pretty straightforward principles of high reliability.
So how does this model relate to the issue of quality and cost of treatment?
When we look at trying to control cost as providers, you know, Berwick has six buckets of waste, okay? Six buckets of unnecessary resource utilization. It's regarding failures of delivery, coordination, and over-treatment on the clinical side. And on the non-clinical side, it's administrative costs, it's fraud, and it's failures in pricing failures, okay? The thing that I try to focus on in this model is we as clinicians are responsible for the clinical side, the failures or the variation in delivery, coordination, and over-treatment. We have very little control on the failures of pricing, okay? So the cost of drugs and assessing the value of new therapy, and Peter Bach could answer this, you know, obviously much better than I, more eloquently than I, but basically it has to do with the failures of pricing. And we have very little control over that. So there is so much work to be done, I think, on the clinical side of delivery coordination and over treatment that is, you know, all about what we do in terms of our decision making. And it turns out that there's a lot of resources used up when there are failures or variation in the way that care is delivered, coordinated, and patients are overtreated. So, you know, I think that in answer to your question about assessing the value of the cost of new therapeutic agents, you can make a case that there are pricing failures. I would say there's a pretty broad range of success in terms of getting the pricing right. You can make a case that some new therapies may have the pricing near the mark. I'm not saying that any actually do, related to the value that they deliver. But there are some that are probably on target and some that are off target. And market forces are not free to operate in this current healthcare environment. Payers who are ultimately responsible, with patients having an increasingly higher burden of out-of-pocket expenses for new therapies, new targeted therapies, are not in a position to modify resource utilization or the costs or the expenditure in these new therapeutic agents. We as physicians are forced to be in an area where we're trying to help patients meet their out-of-pocket expenses, which are substantial and highly variable from one patient demographic to the next, and then trying to devise the best clinical approach for that patient. And oftentimes, and I see it more and more, the economic burden for the patient and the pushback from some of the insurance folks really alters the approach that we're taking. But it's mostly from the patient cost side where the approach is significantly altered. So, you know, I think it's a huge problem. The pricing of new therapies is a huge problem that's on the horizon. It's a problem already. I think it may get larger. And it's a barrier to the execution of care that might be in the patient's best interest. So again, this model really encourages physicians to look at the resource utilization, which we control clinically, which again is related to the delivery of care, the coordination, and guarding against overtreatment and unnecessary resource utilization. Not restricting access to care or therapy, but making sure that we're not wasting resources. And you know, the other part of healthcare reform is really the demonstration of results. And as technology really infiltrates our practices and our records more and more, which is a good thing, there's more data collected. Once it's collected, it has a tendency to become transparent. When data becomes transparent, there's greater accountability and more of an urge to pay attention to the data. The other thing that I often mention is that, you know, quality and cost are really intertwined. So for example, I mentioned the IOM definition of quality, the degree to which health services increase the likelihood of desired outcomes and are consistent with current professional knowledge. Cost is the total resource utilization. And I like to refer to value as the IOM definition for quality, with the statement added that it's the likelihood of driving desired outcomes and delivered with the proper allocation of resources. One example that I give is if a provider is adhering to NCCN guidelines or vendor pathway programs and adhering to multidisciplinary guidelines from the Commission on Cancer, the thought is that they're delivering high quality care. If their patients don't have access, easy access for unscheduled issues, if their patients are spending time in the ER, consuming resources, if they're being admitted inappropriately through an ER because of the lack of sharing of or the ability to share information, even if they're adhering to the greatest standards, whether it's COPE or NCQA or so on, if they're doing that, they're delivering poor quality care. So unnecessary resource utilization is poor quality of care. And I think that that's an issue that many folks don't entirely grasp at this point. From a perspective of providers, Neil, when we as oncologists think about driving value and lowering cost, we think about the NCCN guidelines. Do we adhere? Do we try to adhere? We think about the Commission on Cancer standards, management standards. We think about COPI certification. We think about responding to the IOM critiques of cancer care. And we think that if we do that, we're really driving quality. And, you know, we do reduce some costs in paying attention to those areas of activity. You know, if we adhere to treatment guidelines, we probably do spend less money on chemotherapy drugs. We render appropriate therapy. There's efficiencies and cost reductions with appropriate therapy from the start of the diagnosis and the first approach. And, you know, when we become a little more accountable for what we do in terms of guideline adherence, there's also some benefits in terms of how we approach end of life. So basically, when we as oncologists, and myself included previously, would think of driving quality, I would think of this kind of a diagram. What we actually did, Neil, in terms of getting to this point, was we paid a lot of attention to Alice Gosfield and Jim Reinertsen's paper, Doing Well by Doing Good, Improving the Business Case for Quality. And it was really all about a focus of understanding the physician work environment and the barriers that we faced as physicians. That was part of it. And the other was that the exchange of information in the act of delivering care, you know, the transfer of information from this hard drive to the patient's hard drive. So the paper is actually 10 or 12 years old, and it's actually more applicable today than it was 12 years ago. But it talked a lot about the act of delivering care, the explanation, the prediction, and the plan of care, the transfer of information, how physicians need to be engaged, and their care team needs to be the portal to the rest of the healthcare system, and about the barriers that we faced. So we applied some of the principles and recommendations of that paper into a different approach at driving quality. And it was really all about streamlining our processes, standardizing roles and responsibilities, minimizing clinically irrelevant physician activity, improving patient and family engagement, and develop systems that fixed accountability for the execution of care at the locus of control. And we added a couple of other features, which was, you know, create data systems that could track performance so that we could continuously improve our performance. So we did that. And not only did we improve guideline adherence and provide care along the lines of the Commission on Cancer Standards, but we enhanced patient access, we improved navigation, coordination, and communication, and we ended up reducing potentially avoidable complications and reducing unnecessary resource utilization. The summary of what we did, how we equipped our practice, we did develop a capability to continually reassess and improve our care delivery. It required the construction of a software overlay, or an app as we call it. And we as physicians in our practice spend probably 90% of our time in this app. The rest of our practice, the administrative assistants and nursing team and so on, spend 100% of their time in the oncology-specific EMR. We see the recognition 10 years ago, and we really kind of refined the model as an integrated care delivery model, you know, very much along the Wagner chronic care model and the PCMH principles for both hematology and oncology care, with a lot of emphasis on access, engagement, shared decisions, and so on. We are working with radiation oncology practices currently in a couple of health systems to really have the medical oncology practices serve as the hub of coordination in terms of really creating a, you know, a PCMH neighborhood. One of the things that I really tried to do, Neil, was to really incorporate all the good works and thoughts regarding chronic care models and apply it to oncology. And so the idea here is, you know, how do you create a patient-centered medical home neighborhood for oncology? How do you best utilize the time and the resources that the radiation oncologists are spending in terms of data collection, even the surgical oncologist? How are you best directing patients in an oncology PCMH neighborhood regarding who to call for what? How are you efficiently collecting consistent data regarding that patient's history, their background, their comorbid conditions, the symptoms that they've dealt with? How do you do that? And so because we did it in a medical oncology setting, and because the medical oncologist by default, you know, we're internists, we take care of patients, we don't assume control of their medical conditions, their comorbid medical conditions, but guess what? We impact their comorbid conditions, and because we impact with therapy primarily, we're accountable for triaging and notifying the appropriate folks who are managing their comorbid conditions, primary care or specialist. So because we kind of collect this data, and of the three arms of the execution of cancer care, surgery, radiation, and medical oncology, we generally, by default, have the most robust data that is pertinent to that patient's complicated care. So the idea was that the medical oncology practice would serve as the hub of data concentration and then therefore communication and accountability in meeting cancer care needs. And we don't have really any pushback. You know, once we get past the immediate post-operative period, we don't have any pushback from the radiation oncology folks or the surgical folks regarding the concept of the fact that we are the point of first triage, because we have the best book of data, or the most complete book of data, so that we can provide the best direction during therapy. Anyway, the idea was to integrate the primary care PCMH practices into this neighborhood, the surgeons, radiation oncologists, inpatient care, social workers, hospice services, they all benefit from this information hub. The value proposition, which we saw starting to occur in 2008 or 9, was that we were delivering what we were measuring internally, it would classify as better care because it was more consistent care. Our patients were staying out of the ER and they were staying out of the hospital. They weren't being admitted. So our patients, we think, were experiencing better health. And we have systems, Neil, that really follow longitudinally and present to the physician with every interaction a longitudinal scorecard in terms of how we're palliating symptoms and how we're improving performance status, or how performance status might be changing that we need to address. So we thought we were affecting better health in our patient population. And because we kept people out of the ER and out of the hospital and really engaged them so that they were coming to our practice for unscheduled visits, we substantially lowered cost of the variable that we could affect by, again, focusing on the clinical domain of Berwick's six buckets of waste, which was the way the care was delivered, coordinated, and regarded against over-treatment. I'll talk about over-treatment a little bit later when it comes to end-of-life care. So we thought we had a new value proposition, and gradually there was payer support and recognition was slow. You know, we're 5 years into this, and we're kind of unique in that 48% of our patient base is covered with alternate payment arrangements with two payers in our market. But ACOs have paid attention. Cancer care regarding the emerging ACOs is kind of a black box. It's a low volume, highly variable cost issue that ACOs are going to have to deal with. And they're looking for value-based specialists that can execute, again, at this level of providing enhanced management of chronic care. And health systems that are developing clinically integrated networks and taking some degree of risk are also beginning to pay attention as well. So one of the things, Neil, that I've used frequently, and it really helps in terms of people understanding what the model is, it's looking at this value and quality driver diagram, which is the next slide. So this is an oncology PCMH quality and value driver diagram. And as I mentioned earlier, there are some great secondary drivers of cancer care based on the tremendous work of some terrific organizations that are interested in specifically addressing the execution of the science of cancer care. And there are other organizations that are interested in addressing the consistency of process. So the secondary drivers are really all about the standardization of process and science. And in that secondary driver column, we have the NCQA standards, which again, they have embedded in them the Wagner chronic care model. And it's the NCQA PCMH standards, which have been adopted for oncology care through the patient-centered specialty practice standards, and also the patient-centered oncology care standards, which we're developing with the NCQA in the PCORI-funded study in southeastern Pennsylvania. So you have those standards. You have the American College of Physicians saying, yes, what we need is a neighborhood. We want our specialists to become neighbors. We want better coordination. We want coordination of care arrangements, expectations, a responsibility matrix, so that we can better coordinate care. And the ball is not dropped. So we want standardization there. We have terrific patient advocacy groups, the American Cancer Society, the National Coalition for Cancer Survivorship, and the cancer support community, which recently had a report rendered regarding the voice of the patient. So we have those organizations which we need to pay attention to in terms of how we really standardize process and how we deliver care. So we have those organizations. Then we have the science behind cancer care delivery with the American College of Surgeons, NCCN, ASCO, and so on, and the critiques, the appropriate critiques from the IOM in terms of how we're executing care. All of those buckets of, or these secondary drivers, have an influence on the main activities that we try to execute as the primary driver of cancer care. So the primary driver of cancer care in the center is the physician-led care team. And this is the area, Neil, that people have not really been focusing on and that we really focus intently on. So it's really all about how you execute care. So how the process standards and the scientific standards impact on the way that we engage and orient our patients, how they understand their responsibility to become avid and rapid reporters of symptoms, how they understand how their responsibility is to call us, that we act as the point of first triage when symptoms arise between visits, how they're accountable to lean on us and let us embrace the responsibility of truly caring for them for all aspects of their care. Again, I'm not talking about having us manage diabetes or congestive heart failure, but I'm talking about them having a responsibility to report symptoms which may deal with comorbid conditions so that we can direct to primary care or specialists who are managing those comorbid conditions. So it's really about how all those process and science standards influence engagement and orientation. It's about patient navigation. It's about having prompt entry from the primary care practice, or the ER for that matter, of symptomatic patients that need to be embraced by caregivers who can best direct their care in a timely fashion. So this has to do with the results of Medicare demonstration projects, whether it was about cancer care or not. Most of them actually weren't about cancer care. But in every quality and cost Medicare demonstration project, and there's been about 34 that have been based on a couple of different models, there's been a clear understanding that there is significant patient suffering and resource utilization in the form of ER visits and admissions for patients who are symptomatic before they get in the hands of the people who are going to become responsible for their care. And we see that a lot in oncology. So navigating patients to the medical home, the oncologist medical home, and then having them have their symptoms addressed and then shortening the timeline from symptom to diagnosis and treatment to look more like this than like this, as it does in many cases. So it's patient navigation into the medical home. It's navigation through the complex maze of scheduling laboratory testing or complex imaging. It's navigating them to the other specialists that they need. And it's following up and making sure that they comply with those activities that we schedule with our patient navigators. And then it's navigating patients through the complex act of decision-making, shared decision-making. You know, in healthcare in general, I mentioned earlier that healthcare has been defined as a provider, a physician, exchanging information with the patient regarding explanation of their condition, of their symptoms, prediction of the natural history of their disease, and then developing a plan of care. In cancer care, it's explanation, prediction, treatment options, which are growing, financial counseling for the individual patient, patient goals, life goals, especially in those patients who are in a non-curative setting, and then the development of a plan of care. It's a little more complicated than general healthcare. So it's navigating patients through that process in a consistent way so that there is shared decision-making and full visibility of patient goals by the provider, and elucidation and acknowledgement of patient goals by the patient. So it's navigating through some complicated waters. And that, again, that's based on both the standardization of the process and the science. And that's a little bit of what I had mentioned before about the art of delivering care, cancer care in this case, based on standardization of process and science. You know, it's about the execution of care, the coordination, the communication between specialists involved in the patient's care, the execution of care both internally within the practice and externally with the other specialists. So internally within the practice, one of the things that we found was most important was you really had to integrate workflow with process and really integrate your data collection, data presentation to the doctor or advanced practitioner, and consistently document the response of the caregiver to that data, creating documentation that could form as a vehicle for communication and coordination externally. So there's, again, standardization of process and standardization of science around the execution of care. Symptom management, we talked about earlier, having defined algorithms and having defined processes that patients can understand. Again, the point of first triage, who do you call us. What do? We answer the phone, and we have a well-trained team that has your full book of data. Again, they're not fishing for data. It's not 30 questions, but they have a full book of data regarding comorbid conditions, current medications, recommendations from the last visit, history of how those symptoms may have been managed in the past, and clear direction in algorithms that nurses can operate, again, at the level of their license, in executing the recommendation in a few minutes, not a few hours later after the doctor got involved in the loop. We have algorithms that, again, is standardizing the science and the process. So you have algorithms where there's a nursing domain and then a physician domain. And if the nurse crosses that line, physicians are interrupted and involved. So it's, again, process and science around symptom management. Survivorship care, it's, again, process and science around that. It's the ASCO recommendations for appropriate follow-up in terms of reimaging, in terms of laboratory testing. And it's standardization of process with the primary care team about who's responsible for what. Now, historically, primary care practices have shied away from being accountable or responsible for executing a survivorship care plan. But as the technology gets better, and there are some primary care practices that are capable of taking a care plan, a survivorship care plan that we design as oncologists, again, based on standardized process and science, and we can hand it over to them if they have the IT systems that can ensure execution. So having consistent survivorship care based on the staging and the site of disease and so on. Goals of therapy, again, this is the domain of the physician-led care team, and you can define goals of therapy at the outset. You can have a discussion regarding advanced care planning at the outset. It's a single snapshot, usually when the patients are feeling their best. And you can document that, and that's fine. It opens the door to a discussion regarding advanced care planning. But goals of therapy and end-of-life care decisions, it's an iterative process based on dialogue between the physician-led care team, usually the physician, and that patient. And there can be external interventions and measurements and education and help and support, but how that incremental process is followed in a rational manner depends on a one-on-one interaction between the patients and their physician primarily. So how do you document when goals of therapy should be changed? How do you engage patients around a conversation that they and their families can understand? And one of the things that the approach that we took and the approach that we encourage in this model, and in fact, it's also being embraced by the oncology care model, is the measurement of performance status. Performance status is a concept that patients and their families can understand and doctors need to be mindful of before we talk to a patient about third or fourth line therapy in some unique situations. So the question then became, how do you collect that information around performance status? How do you standardize it and present it to a doc? And then how do you make the doctor accountable for addressing potential changes in goals of therapy at the point of care when there are changes in performance status that might be related to disease progression or the progressive intervention of comorbid conditions in the patient's abilities? So we've devised a way to do that. And again, it's collecting the data, presenting it to the doctor, and then having systems that encourage them to respond to changes in performance status. And so that's an area where there's a huge benefit to standardizing, again, process and science for the benefit of the provider, the patient, and the payer, quite frankly. There's a lot of parameters, there's a lot of performance knowledge in this center column that really drive the desired outcomes, which are very patient and payer centric, and that's around the triple aim. So, for example, there's a lot of outcomes in the center column of activities that the payers can't even begin to measure or verify, and that patients don't really see. It's behind-the-scenes activity. And so that's what we're focused on in this model, and that's what we're focused on supporting to really drive the desired outcomes. And the desired outcomes are really self-evident. It's the right care, the right multidisciplinary care, the right drugs, you know, better patient and family engagement, prompt palliation of symptoms, you know, providing palliative care at the moment of the introduction to the oncology practice.
Can you talk about the potential benefits to a practice regarding the standardization of process and having some technology support to standardize the science of cancer care?
Our model that we've been promoting is a little different than some other models that have emerged and some other pilots that have emerged in different parts of the country. There's a tendency for practices to say, you know, we're already doing a lot of the services, and there's a tendency to have services not really redesigned, but to have added services so that the practice can be more responsible for improving delivery coordination and so on. So there's an additive model that calls for extended hours or weekend hours and so on. You know, we took an approach that engaging patients in a very straightforward way and then measuring their response to those engagement efforts, we found that as we improved our patient engagement, we didn't require after-hours care. We do have a physician who has access to the full book of data for that patient, the full spectrum of their records on call. But by engaging patients more fully, and their families, by the way, we managed to have most of our symptom-related calls come in during the hours of 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. So we initially had, for example, Saturday hours 5 years ago. As we got better at engaging patients and remind them that as the weekend approached, that on Thursday and Friday, they should really anticipate being seen and report to us if they have issues so that we can help them get through the weekends, we abandoned Saturday hours. So as a result of process standardization and streamlining our care in this model, we also reduced the number of FTEs per doctor. So for example, in 2006 or 7, we had about 8.3 FTEs per physician, which was right about at the average that was reported by Tom Barr in Oncometrics. As we went through this transformation process, this redesign of our services, not the addition of resources and personnel, but the redesign of existing personnel and resources, we arrived at the current numbers really in 2012 of about 5.6 FTEs per physician. Now, we had about a 30% reduction in number of FTEs per doctor by going through this process. We didn't have a 30% reduction in our salary overhead. We had about a 14% reduction in our salary overhead. So my point is that when you standardize process, you don't add more personnel and cost. You redesign and you actually require less personnel. When you, again, standardize process and science, we've enhanced our fee-for-service arrangements with payers in some cases. We've had per-member, per-month enhancements for our payments for different contracts, and we have shared savings components with some of our payers. We've also had pre-certification relief for things that we don't need to get on the phone for. But we've had pre-certification relief with better communication and better documentation. We've had improved coding and coordination through better documentation and improved physician efficiency, productivity, and quality of life. And because we're doing business differently with the growing community of primary care docs that have embraced the PCMH model, we've opened up new avenues of referrals. So I did mention also that we currently have about 48% of our patient base that are covered in two alternate payment methodologies, and we look forward to participating in the CMS oncology care model, which is planning to be rolled out in the spring of 16. One other thing that I'd like to mention, I did serve on the technical expert panel for CMS and CMMI regarding oncology payment reform, and I also served on the Centers for American Progress bundled payment consortium that Zeke Emanuel headed. And one of the things that I emphasized pretty strongly, both during the meetings and between the meetings, was that before we subject patients and providers to budgeted payment methodologies, and it can be in the form of an episode-based payment or full capitation, that's the range. But before we subject patients and the providers to budgeted payment methodologies, we need to make certain that there is standardization of process and science. And again, that's the PCMH model. And the PCMH model with standardization of process and science really acts as a patient safety net as we become more conscious of spending and more accountable for total cost of care. And I think that the oncology care model has kind of embraced PCMH services and standards. And so I think that message was actually heard. So I'd like to just end here with a couple of comments. And again, this is repetitious, but as a provider of complex care to a increasingly challenging patient population that is expanding in numbers and complexity, the standardization of process and the standardization of the application of the science of cancer care is essential so that we can fully practice the art of oncology in the future.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Sprandio, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special Think Tank Roundtable on Quality and Value in Oncology Care.